guy just got up and was thrilled that he's here with his new book out for the release. And I'm going to give us advance insight on his work and show us how to get shades right.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about change in organization. I'm here to tell you that despite information overload, despite conflicting priorities, despite managers who have no idea what they're doing, and despite the bad of the day, that you can get large groups of people to create rapid, widespread change. That you can make it happen. I've done it. I've done it in many organizations. I started off working with Steve Denning, who did it at the World Bank. Multicultural, multidisciplinary, geographically distributed. I've done it with nurses. I've done it with analysts. I've done it with accountants. I've done it with defense. I've done it at NASA. I've done it in a lot of places. And you can make it happen, right? We all feel like we're living in floodland, right? It's like there's so much going on. How are we ever going to get anything to go through the system? I'm going to tell you with a few different ways of kind of screwing your head on, you can make this stuff happen. That in fact, people want to get things done. That when you give them a way to follow their passion, follow their bliss, and do it so that it's coherent with what you're trying to achieve, that you will see rapid, widespread change. But before I get into that, I'm going to take you far afield. I'm going to take you into a couple of domains that people don't usually talk about when they talk about organizational change. But those of you who know me have been here before. The first, in 1979, I dropped out of graduate school to do street theater. I did it for 10 years. I performed on the street where my audiences were people who were going someplace else. I had to stop this. I had to be worthy. I had to be compelling. And what I got interested in was not just getting them to stop and look at me, because you can do some really strange stuff and make that happen fast. But you will sabotage what I was most interested in, which is that I wanted them to feel compelled to join me. I wanted them to want to be part of the show, part of the event. And I studied that for 10 years. Now, in theater, there's something called the fourth wall. And I know we have some theatricians here in the room as well. Right? You have stage right, stage left, you have backstage, and the fourth wall. The fourth wall is between the performers and the audience. Now, you can start playing tricks with people, like if I were suddenly to tell you all that, actually, the fourth wall is back there, and you're on stage. That would work for about 3 or 4 seconds. And if you were standing on the street while you were going somewhere else, what you would probably, and you still wanted to watch me, you might just leave, but if you still wanted to watch me, what you would do is you would just quickly back up until once again it was between us. Right? So you can't just trick people into it. You have to give them a reason that they find compelled to be part of it. They want to be part of it. And that's the secret of making change work, too. So, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how that works, what theater has to offer those of you who are really working hard to mobilize change in the organization. And the second place I'm going to take you is in rites of passage, initiation. Because when you are getting people to move to another state, you are taking them through a rite of passage. And if you think, I'm just going to use one as an example, my favorite is the adolescent rite of passage. If you think about what happens when you take an adolescent to become an adult, I'm going to characterize it very generally. You start off with somebody who is dependent. If the shit hits the fan, they go to mom and dad to figure out what to do. Right? They've even been studied. The little baby kids, 2-year-olds on a playground, fall, hurt themselves, but don't know if it's bad or not. So what do? They send out a little alarm. I'm here. And they turn, and they look at mom, who's sitting on the park bench. And if mom starts going, they go, oh, I'm in deep. I am bad. But if mom just looks at her and keeps on talking, they just get up and dust themselves off because they don't know. They don't know if they've been seriously hurt. So they need to read the mind of the adult who's responsible for them. They're dependent on that. It's critical information. And the same thing is when they need to be fed, when they need to be clothed, when there's a storm, when everything changes suddenly, they go to adults. That's how people behave in organizations when they're not engaged. right? They're dependent on their boss to tell them what to do. They have a checklist. They punch a card. They go in and out. They look to other people to tell them if it's serious or not. We're reorganizing this vice presidency. They go to the division chief. Are we in deep yogurt or what? You know, does this mean us? Are we our heads on the block? We need to put our resumes in order, or should we just kind of like bide our time? This one will pass over like the last one did. What you want is you want them to move away from that, and you want them to move into what's called an adult co-contributor state. An adult co-contributor takes accountability for helping to shape the future of their tribe, their community. They're in it all the way. If they don't go out and kill the deer, there's nothing to eat tonight. Right? If they don't make the future happen, it's not going to happen. If you work at the World Bank and you're about alleviating poverty and you don't get invested and you don't make sure that those beneficiaries have the resources they need, when you pull out, the thing's going to collapse. And you didn't do your job. You have to figure out how to make it happen. That's an adult. That's a co-contributor state, and that's what you want. So what you're trying to do is move people from this childlike dependent state to this adult co-creator state. That's a rite of passage, and it's not done easily. You don't just flip a switch. You have to have social infrastructure. There's all kinds of moving parts that go into helping people make that transition. Right? And if the infrastructure's there, then actually they can move through the motions and kind of get handheld along the way. They do have to go through an ordeal or two. Like, if you're Jewish, you have to learn to read Hebrew and, you know, understand how to hold that silver pen while you're standing over the Torah. Or, if you're out in the African bush, you might have to stare at a tree for 3 days and wonder if you're actually going to survive the ordeal. There truly is an experience where you feel suddenly you're on the line. And guess what? That's part of adulthood. How many of you have ever had to bring home a paycheck and have children at the same time? Have you ever woken up in the middle of the night and gone, oh crap. If I don't bring it home, nobody brings it home. We don't eat. That's adult reality. Right? And that's where you want people to be. You want them to have the support and the social infrastructure so they can perform, so they can achieve, but you also want them to take that authority and say, it's up to me, I'm going to move into it. So we're going to talk a little bit about rites of passage. These are two areas that have been fundamental in helping me to make change work in organizations. It's a very different way of thinking about it. I'll talk about the book, Getting Change Right, which is coming out, which chunks it out into very particular pieces, but I wanted to start here. Now, let me give you an example of the theater of it all. Go with me on this. Just close your eyes for a moment. Keeping your eyes closed, throw out some of the characteristics of this room. What do you remember about the way this room is laid out? What's in this room?
The wire!
I've been staring at this wire all day long. The wire that's winding its way through the building. Yeah, the wire. All right, what else?
Calder on the wall.
What's on the wall?
Calder.
Calder on the wall. What else?
No windows.
No windows.
High ceiling.
Piano.
Fluorescent. What?
Piano.
Narrow
cluttered.
Long, narrow stage space. Okay.
A lot of people.
And what are all those people doing? Are they sitting in pen points each other? Are they in circles? They're all facing the front, mostly. What did that tell you? Okay, open your eyes now. Imagine this were a theater setting. Imagine that someone had come through this room and painstakingly constructed it the way that it is. That this piece of masking tape was put there on purpose. That this rip in the drywall was intentional. That these microphone jacks are not really microphone jacks. They're plates that somebody had to go to the hardware store and buy, and the stage designer had to determine where to put them and said, let's put them right behind the speaker up here. Imagine that. What would you interpret about this show?
Bad design.
Bad design. Why bad design?
It's not given a proper context to the message being sent out or the introduction.
It's not reinforcing the message, assuming that we know what the message is, which is we're assuming this about storytelling in the Smithsonian Manual of Organization. Right. So it's not supporting that. Yes?
It's not engaging. I mean, I'm turned off.
Right. Fluorescent lights. No. You know, we just kind of gel out into fuzzland, right? What else?
I mean, I'm not sure it's not what it's not, but why would someone then go to that end? What kind of experience do they want us to have here? If they've gone to this effort to design it like this, there must be... What experience works in this setting?
Right, right. What is this about?
In fact, there might even be metaphors going on here. This is maybe, if there was no wires behind this wall, then that means something. There's an intentionality here. This wire is about something. This is not just random flotsam that's floating through the room. Somebody constructed this.
These two rooms, they had these rooms were over here. Two rooms, and so they took the movable wall away. This was never intended to be the front of the room.
This was never intended to be the front of the room. All right, now I want you to start thinking about your meetings this way. We don't. We're oblivious to them. And it makes a huge, huge difference. When I go to a vacant lot to put on a performance piece, I know I can't move the fire hydrant. I got to figure out how to use it. If I don't figure out how to use it, it's a distraction and a diversion, and that's a problem. I have to use it. I can't ignore it. I might be able to put something on top of it. I might be able to do something with it. But if I ignore it, it then sits there in the middle of the show, sucking up attention while I'm trying to do something else. Not good. But this happens all the time in organizations. Let me give you two examples of how important this can be. When I was working at the World Bank, there was a meeting that our president, Jim Wolfenson, had with the managing directors. 500, not the managing directors, the directors, 500 staff, 500 directors. Big room. And the meeting did not go well. He had an ambitious change initiative. It was going on. The meetings were getting worse and worse until finally it climaxed in something that was called the glass wall meeting. And what happened in the glass wall meeting was that Jim was up at the front of the room and he said to his directors, I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to ask if there are any questions. If nobody asks the question, I'm going to tell a joke and I'm going to walk out. I feel like there's a glass wall between us. Are there any questions? Of course, there were no questions. He told the joke. I'm not sure why he did that. And he walked out. And that was the last meeting he had with his directors for 18 months. Now, I got called in. Seth, please fix the meeting. It's not okay. We have an ambitious change agenda. We can't go on with the president not meeting with the directors, which is not a good thing. Okay, so I went into the room and I looked at the way the meeting was set up. The first thing I noticed was that there was a stage. It was about this high. Not like that. And Wolfenson was on it, behind a podium, and all the chairs were facing front. Kind of like you, but much more rigid. They were facing this wall. So that everybody who was over there sat through the whole meeting like this. Right? So it's painful to watch the president, literally. But there were only two rows, or I guess two columns in the whole group that were actually looking at the president easily, and that were these two. Everybody else had their head tilted at an angle. There were two microphones on stand out here. So if anybody wanted to ask a question, they had to stand up, walk over here, and then stand there for a long time, being noticed, right, until they had a chance to ask their question, and then go sit down. I mean, Wolfenson looked like a commandant up there, right? I mean, talking to the troops, this is the way it is, we'll march, you know? That's not what you want. So we created something that became professionally known as the overstyle. And what we did was we got rid of the stage completely. We gave him a podium, because sometimes he likes to stand behind a podium, but we also gave him a coffee table, we gave him an easy chair, we put in plants, we got water, we put everybody in arcs so that everybody was naturally looking. We put breaks in the arcs, aisles, so that people could walk around freely. We served coffee and tea before it started. We told everybody there will be treats, come early. Now, these are directors at the World Bank, so out of 540 people came early, and they came for tea, right? So when everybody else came, when the other 460 people showed up, they walked into a room that was filled with their colleagues who were having polite conversation over tea and coffee, instead of into a stiff room where they were going to listen to the boss. It was a completely different atmosphere. Now, I encountered major resistance when we were designing this. For example, we had one of the guys in facilities, GSD is what it was called. I don't know, what did that stand for?
General Services Division.
Department. Yeah. We had this one guy who would go around, get a little metal ruler, and he would measure the distance between every chair. And I said to him, I want the chairs to be curved. And it was kind of like, is that like a 106-degree angle. You know? It's okay with me if it's not any angle. It's even okay with me if it's kind of chaotic. It actually is. I really like that kind of feel of children in a library listening to a storyteller. It's all jumbled. It's a nice feeling. Right? That's nice, but that's kind of what this room has evolved into, naturally. It's still a little, you know, everybody facing front. But we've fallen into that. People that... I had to bribe this guy. He liked big bottles of Perrier. Now, this is what goes on in an organization. I was told, you know, if you want the guy with a little measuring thing to not just go off the deep end, bring in big bottles of Perrier. Well, I came in with my big bottles of Perrier. And we're going to have a conversation, right? This is about smoothness. It's about curves. It's about flow. There were many instances like that. The organization was not designed to create this kind of semi-casual, semi-business experience. It was everything, but the infrastructure was in place for a different kind of event to happen. And to push just for little stuff like this, just for little stuff like this. So that's an example of how this can make a huge difference. Now, another example, I teach, I taught at leadership classes at NASA for many years. And these are aspiring project managers who are going to have to go before their peers and ask for money for their projects. And it's a scary thing for them. Imagine that you're standing up in front of a bunch of your colleagues asking for $16 million to, you know, fund a satellite that's going to study gas in deep space or something like that. And the way it's set up is that there's this panel of chairs, and it's like you're grilled. You get up in front of the room and you make your case. You know, this is why we need to study gas in deep space. And people are taking shots at you. It's kind of like, pull! Oh! But a lot of it has to do with the way the room is set up. So I started playing with it. I said, this is a class. We can do whatever we want. And just that part alone starts making me nervous. Right? It's class time. I mean, nobody's judging it. So let's play with the room. And we would put the chairs in a circle. Kumbaya style. Right? Put the chairs in a circle and ask them to ask for money. How does that feel? Well, it feels different. That's interesting. Now I say, all right, just make all the chairs feel particularly all over the room and lay on them like you're a bunch of teenagers, you know, in the basement watching TV. So people got their legs on the chair. Now I ask for the money. That's a lot easier. So what? It's a lot easier. So why don't you do that? Well, we can't do that. You know, that would be unforgivable. $16 million is on the line. Why can't you do it? When people really want their $16 million, where do they do the ask? In the bar. What's going on in the bar? Right? Think about that. So why do we have these structures? It's like they're part of our lives. We don't question them. And they create these results that are not what we want. And we don't push against them. We don't treat them. When you're doing street theater, all of this stuff is scary. You start putting on the show back there behind the camera if you want. Do whatever you want, right? So bring that in. Give yourself the flexibility. Ask yourself, what's the result I'm after? And how do I construct an event that is going to provide the result that we want? Now, a lot of the work that I do is with economists, it's with analysts, it's with engineers, it's with scientists, it's with accountants. These are not touchy-feely types, right? What's the old saying? Their version of emotional intimacy is that they're looking at your shoes while they're talking to you instead of their own. So you still have all of these issues in play. It doesn't come, it's not like if you're in a particular discipline, you stop being a human being. You don't. You don't. And these structures grow. So I'm going to ask Larry Foster. Someone who's standing behind the camera here is helping me out. Larry Foster is an employee at Shell in New Orleans, and I worked at Shell for almost 3 years, and we had a chance to work on a few sessions together. We had a chance to design a particular session where we wanted to create a breakthrough, a freeing up of energy around the adoption of some technology. Now, in this session, we identified, I'll talk to you when I go through the steps about how we did this, but we identified what I call the most valuable players. Who are the people who you want to be in contact with in order to change the system? Where are they? They could be accountants if they're in charge of the resources. They could be a vice president to make a decision. For us, we found that there were some of the guys who worked on the assets, the rigs out in the Gulf of Mexico, the guys who had dirty fingernails, wanted to talk to somebody else who'd use this technology. And so we went to, where did we get the PowerPoint slides from? Was it, I want to say Africa? Was it,
Brunei.
We went to Brunei because in Brunei they had actually used the technology, and there were people who stood on the platforms who had the experience who could answer the questions of these guys who were in our room. Now, when we were assembling this, these are people in the oil and gas industry. We start to ask ourselves, what does a breakthrough event look like in the oil and gas industry? What should the stage look like? What kind of props should be in the room? What is going to give these people the message that a legitimate breakthrough can happen? We've all been invited to meetings where we know nothing's going to happen, right? And when we're lucky, we don't go to them. We make the decision early on. But sometimes you get an invitation to a meeting and you say to yourself, this could be hot. Something special could happen here. Why? What are your cues? Think of it like going to the show. When you go to Cats, right, or Les Miserables, there's that air. You know, there's that energy. People put on nice clothes, picked up in a nice car, there's a buzz out on the sidewalk. You know you're going to laugh, you're going to cry, you're expecting that experience. You're going to be dazzled with, you know, someone like Andrew Lloyd Rice. Andrew Rice Webber?
Webber.
You know this person. You know the lyrics are going to be phenomenal. The music's going to be incredible. You're going to be singing this for months, right? And there's all this anticipation. There's nothing to keep us from having that kind of breakthrough anticipation around work when we're doing something exciting. But it never happens. Because nobody's paying attention to it. If you pay attention to it, you can cultivate it. Let's get the vice president to kick off the meeting. What do engineers want? Well, one thing they want is reams of data. So let's have it in the room. Let's get the reams of data. Take it seriously. What are their cues? What are they going to want to pour through? How do they know? What are the triggers for them that say, this could really be a breakthrough? We could change the way we work. We could do the right thing for a change. This could be awesome. We could see collaboration like we've never seen it before. Something sets them up for that, and it's your job to know what it is and put it in place. So that's one of the places where the theater comes in. All right, so let me ask you to grab your handout here. All right, let's see. One side's got a picture of the cover of my book, Getting Things Right, in orange and gray. And it's filled with quotes. It tells you it's a wonderful book. Turn it over to the other side. Communication and Transformational Leadership, a syllabus for leaders of organizational change. This is a syllabus that I was asked to design for an agency, which will go nameless, here in Washington, D.C., one of our favorites. This syllabus is married to my book. That's why I put it on here, because you can basically see the chapter title here, these 8 chapters. And that's what I want to go through, and then I want to teach you how we do some of the steps that we do. So the first chapter is called Creating Rapid, Widespread Engagement, and it includes ways to penetrate information overload, how you create a shared stake in success, and designing conversations that create the future. Here's the main point of the first step. We have communication screwed up in organizations. We think that communication is about crafting a message, sending it out through the media, getting it through to somebody, and having them decode it and understand it. That comes from Shannon and Weaver. That model was created in 1940. It was published in the 1960s. It fell last. It is the communication model that made computers possible. It made the internet possible. It's about sending bits of data through a medium where it's interfered with by noise, and it totally sucks when it comes to the way humans relate to each other. And yet, it is by default the model that all communication teams work with when they're on a change initiative. We will go to the source, the change leader. He or she will tell us what the message is. We will turn that message into media, like email, town hall, posters, mouse pads. We will send it out to the masses, and provided they are not distracted and that they can focus, and i.e. there's no noise in the system, they will decode that message, they will receive it, and they will understand what we are trying to say. It's a bad model. Human beings don't work that way. If you did work that way, you could go to the library, pick up a book, and put it down and have everything that's in it now inside your head. But we don't do that. We need teachers and students. Why do we need teachers and students? Because we build meaning socially. It's a social act. We do it together. The phrase in the industry is called social construction. We construct things with other people. Meaning. It's messy, it's iterative, but you have to have more than one brain in one room at a time to make it happen. And there has to be true interaction. It's not about me tossing you a football across the room and hopefully you catching it. That is not what communication is about. It's this process where someone throws something out, someone else either, you know, objects to it or asks another question or takes a tangent on it or agrees with it, and then they throw something back, and you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But you know what most change initiative people do? And I know this because I've watched them. I've led these teams before. Right? I'm not working on that process. You go down that road. What they do is they say, okay, first we've got to get the idea really good. We got to understand it. We've got to understand the logical argument. We've got to gather the data. It has to be bulletproof. We have to know exactly what we're going to do. We have to know how it's going to work from beginning to end before we tell anybody about it. And you know what? That's all a farce. Life doesn't work that way. Now, you do have to have data. You do have to have a good idea. You do have to be on to something. If you don't, you're doomed. So they're required. I'm not saying you shouldn't believe in data. Far from it. I'm just saying that's not how ideas spread. That's not how you create rapid, widespread change. It doesn't happen like that. So what you need is once you've got your core idea, which you've probably already got if you're talking about a change program, it's already there. You know the 80-20 rule? You're there. You need to start talking to people about it. You need to start talking to the right people about it. You need to have a lot of conversations. Conversations with people that are going to make you feel uncomfortable because they're going to ask you questions that you don't have answers for. And that's why you're doing it. So it's a whole different way to think about how communication works. I worked on two knowledge management teams at the World Bank. The first team was the team who didn't tell anybody about what they were doing. We had a budget, a big budget. We brought in highly paid consultants. We had visibility. The president, Jim Wilkinson, knew what we were doing. The CIO, Mohammed Nissen, knew what we were doing. And they were watching us every day, day in, day out. We had really cool toys. We were building an intranet in 1996. We had demos that would make your mouth water, but there were only 5 mouths watering for a whole year. We never told anybody what we were doing. And at the end of that year, I resigned. I'm out of here. This mission is going nowhere. And this guy, Steve Denning, stopped into my office while I was typing my letter of resignation and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm out of here. This initiative is going nowhere. Now, I wasn't working with him yet. He said, give me an hour. An hour later, I got called to the CIO office, and he said, you're on loan to Steve Denning, along with Leslie Stair, who's sitting right here. Steve had half of an executive assistant. That's him, and he had no money. No money. And if you read my book, you will read an interview with Steve where he talks about why it's to your advantage to work without budget or authority. It's to your advantage to work without budget or authority. So we went on loan to him. Steve tried to figure out how can we talk to as many people as possible as fast as possible. That was his goal. And you know, we ended up with storytelling. That's one of the reasons why we're here. 2 years later, we had $60 million in annual allocations. We had built 115 communities around the planet. Today, what is this now? We're like, it's 96, so we're 14 years later. You know, the institutional pendulum has swung. We've had presidents who've been booted out of office. We've had budget constrictions. We've had people come through with their sabers and slash things right and left. Today, you can find communities of practice that we started here and there all over the organization because they're meeting about real stuff. Real stuff. This stuff persists. So you got to change this model from communication is about me fashioning something and pitching it to them to it's us creating the future together. It's built on interaction. You've got to have a two-way street. Okay. That's the reason that chapter one is because everything else comes out of that. Everything else. I'm going to go through these others fast because I want to get into some of the how-to. But I want to just expose you to these core principles here. Two, you communicate so people get it and spread it. This is a little bit of a trick. It is not a noun. It is a verb. The it is a contagious conversation. It's not a message. It's not a mantra. It's not seven words that you can put up on the wall. It's not your mission statement. It's imagine what it would be like if we did this. We had this rural healthcare worker in Zambia find one of the cures for malaria on the web. And she got it off the website of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. None of our information was available about that. Imagine if it was. What could that do? That was a conversation that went like wildfire through our organization. And you know what? We didn't have to be there. We had no money. Remember, we couldn't be there. We had no ability to supervise. But it spread because that was a question worth asking. Number three, energize your most valuable players. I call them the MVPs. Larry likes to talk about our dynamic list of MVPs because we know they change every day. When we were working in Shell, we literally kept a list of these people, and every time we got together, we reviewed the list, who's in, who's out, what new has happened. It changes all the time. They're inside and outside the organization. They're not constrained to the institutional hierarchy, though they might be resident there. You just don't know. They could be vendors. They could be partners. They could even be detractors and competitors. Who are the people who influence the system? Think of your future state as a social network and ask the question, who are the influencers who are going to make that manifest? Those are your MVPs. In the book, I give you a list of 14 categories to help you jog your memory, and you can sit there and you can make a list of who are these people, and then you want to energize them. Now, one of the wonderful things about doing a change initiative is you've got something really cool to work on. And most people in most organizations don't. Now, if you run across somebody whose eyes are glazed over and who moves, you know, the only direction they go is towards the cafeteria to get a cup of coffee and then kind of stagger, that doesn't mean that they're a screwed up human being. It just means they're working in a screwed up environment. And if you give them something fun to do, something compelling, something exciting, something that aligns with where they want to see their lives go, they will suddenly spring to life and you have an animated, energized professional on your hands who will work on your behalf. And that's what energizing your most valuable players is all about. And you can do that. Number four, understand the story of change, or the territory of change. This is one of my favorites because it's all about story listening. You need to understand the map of the culture that you're in. Now, every map does a good job of telling you how you can get from here to there fast. What if there's a roadblock? What if there's construction? What if there's a storm? We can go around. We can go do this way. Stay out of the swamp over here. Watch out for this road that has potholes. You want a map like that of your organization. And the way you get that map is by asking people to tell you their story. So I'm going to give you now, here's some instructions. At least one person, Ivor. Where's the Ivor in the room? Can I pass your name right? Did I pronounce your name right?
Ivor,
yeah. Ivor, yeah. Ivor asked it. Give me some technical stuff. I need something to take away. So here's one thing. When you ask people about their story, you have the first two priorities. You're doing it to build trust and rapport. So you're engaging in someone, you're respecting, you're listening, you're trying to understand the world the way they see it. It's not about arguing, it's not about justifying, it's not even about making the case for your change initiative. It's like, tell me how it looks to you. And when I do that, I'm looking for five things, and I call them the five gems, and they're listed on the bottom half of this sheet of paper. The first one is I'm looking for red light. A red light is when somebody says to me, you're doomed and this is why. You're going to die, you're going to burn and this is why. This is over before it even started. Let me tell you about it. That's called a red light. The person says, stop. And the correct response to that is, tell me more. Why? You get really good information there. Second is a yellow light. The yellow light says, if you don't talk to the accountant, you're in big trouble. You know, you're never going to get this thing funded. Or if you don't watch out for the other initiative that just came down from headquarters that sounds an awful lot like the one you're trying to do, you guys are definitely going to, you know, be hidden in a log jam of some kind or whatever. Yellow light, cautions are important. You want to listen for those. The next thing is themes. A theme is anything that more than one person says. Period. It does not have to be rational. Does not even have to be coherent. It just needs to be something that's floating in the system. You want to know about it. If you talk to a second person and they say the same thing that someone else said, there's a pattern going on. And it's a symptom. It's an indicator. You want to grab a hold of it. The fourth thing is educational deficits. In that technology initiative I was talking about at Shell, one of the things that Larry and I discovered right off the bat was there were people who did not want to implement this technology who really didn't know what it did. So that's called an educational deficit. An educational deficit is when there's something missing that's preventing people from playing a higher game. It's some information that they need. And the best way to deliver it is to have their peers give it to them. Not you, but you're listening. Oh, We have a significant number of people here who have no idea what this technology really does. We've got to make sure that they get an education as part of this process. The last is high-value nuggets, and this is really where the word gems comes from, because when you're listening to people's stories, you'll start to hear things that you go, oh my gosh, that's a huge win if we could do that. And as you sift through the stories, now imagine you have 25 of your most valuable players, or 75, or 50. You're listening to a lot of stories. You end up with a basket full of these gems. And that's what tells you what the territory looks like. Now you've got something you can talk about. So you might say to yourself, there's the dismal swamp of procurement. We know that if we go down this project, if we get mired down there, we're sunk for sure. Well, there's even rumors of this quicksand. There's people who've gone in there and they've never come out. Right? And then there's maybe, you know, the thin river on the amidst the steep canyons over here of, you know, working with overseas partners. You guys are going to go fast. You're going to go furious. You better not wreck on the rock because there's no way out once you're in there. You start getting a sense of what does the territory of this change look like? If we're in trouble, where can we take a shortcut? So that's understanding the territory of change. It happens through story listening. You listen to a lot of stories. You start to collect the patterns and make a map of the territory. Gems, right?
Yes. You don't have to intentionally ask the question telling your story. You can listen for all of these just throughout day-to-day interactions with people.
You can, but what I do is I have a conversation one-on-one with each of those most valuable players. The way I think of it, it's like we're a constellation, like a star constellation. And the point of every star has a different perspective. And I want to understand your perspective if you're one of my most valuable players. Okay. All right. Number five, accelerating change through performance communities. At the World Bank, we call them thematic groups. At Shell, we had a group that was working out of Colorado, working on a Wyoming gas field that was helping us to advance one of the technology changes that we were making. You look for groups of people who share a common passion. This is how human beings work. This comes back to this whole thing about we're social. If you read any of Etienne van der stuff, he's one of the guys who invented the term communities of practice, right? Now he's talking about social learning systems. He's generalized his work to go beyond communities of practice. That includes family. It includes people who are trapped on a bus together if it stops in the middle of a highway or something. Anytime we have a group of people together, we become a social learning system. We start looking to each other for cues. We start sharing knowledge, experience. We start collaborating. We start generating interpretations of reality together. This is how people work. Most organizations fight it.
You two are not the same division. If you're talking, you do it in off time.
That's the wrong approach. If they're talking, there's energy there. How do you make use of that? How do you embrace it? How do you take that energy and use it to fuel your change initiative? At the World Bank, we went looking for these communities. We found five that were existing in this highly community-toxic environment, and they've been there long before we were. And we studied them. We studied what made them work. We did not find communities in boardrooms. We did not find communities in conference rooms. We found them in bars and cafeterias and hallways because they weren't welcome in the organization. Leslie actually led that initiative. What is it that makes these communities work in our organization? And then we figured out how to replicate them. And that was a bit of a process, right? First, one of the things we discovered about these communities was that they had someone, the one that was really successful, the highway group, had this guy in it, Ian, who was good at two things. One is he was a world-class expert, so everybody respected him. And two, he was a party planner. We call him social architect. If he was talking to Janice, and Janice was saying, all my asphalt is falling apart in the Amazon rainforest, and I just can't figure out why. And then he went over to Ivor on the other side of the planet, and Ivor said to him, I was looking in the lab on a humidity-resistant asphalt. Then he would say, you guys need to have lunch together. He was brokering knowledge all the time. This is how he lived. This is who he was. This is what he did. He did it first with a three-ring binder, then a floppy diskette, and a laptop. I mean, it didn't matter what the technology was. He did these two things. So we thought, oh, great, we'll go ask all the world-class experts to become social architects. That didn't work. We held classes, and like five of them showed up out of like 300 or something. So then we figured out, how do we pair somebody with them who does the social architect? And we brought in new hires who were eager to work with world-class experts, and we brought in interns at GW. Who were knowledgeable. They loved it. $500 for a semester. $500 a semester. Buy yourself an intern. So we got so many interns, and Leslie had the great idea. She said, let's hire an intern to manage the interns. We did. So figure out how to make communities work in your organization. They're the natural learning structure of human beings. 6, generate dramatic surges in progress. You do this through specially designed face-to-face events. In my book, I detail what I call touchstone events. This is my jargon. A touchstone event is a way of bringing people together that respects their ability to contribute and helps them to craft the future forward together. I've done these events with 3,500 people. I've done it with 5 people. And this is what I was talking about the theater and how you put something together. In this chapter, I go through in detail how you create one of these special events. Okay, 7, breaking through log jams. You got to have a SWAT team mentality. You know what a SWAT team is? What's a SWAT team? What is it? Special weapons and tactics. Special weapons and tactics. Anybody ever been on a SWAT team?
Not me personally.
But you know people that have. Your brother has. Okay. Think about the people. Okay, these are the guys and gals who have like battering rams that are like as long as this room. Or they have, armored cars that they get to drive through normal cities with, right? You know what they're doing? They're waiting for someone to get kidnapped. They're waiting for a police standoff. That's what they train for, right? They go out in hot weather and they climb up these empty shells of buildings and they practice jumping off of them. They practice negotiation. If you were doing that day in, day out, do you think you want a real situation to happen? Yes! It's time! Get out the toys, right? SWAT team mentality. It's no accident that 2/3 of Steve's original team were facilitators. When something would go wrong, Leslie and Seth were like, yay, let's go do something. What are you groupware, Or whatever it was. Right? We got this new toy. Embrace the logjam. Embrace the obstacle. If you think about what a logjam or an obstacle is, it's a confluence of forces coming in from multiple points, coming to a head in a big knot. You have an opportunity to be Alexander the Great. Really? That's what it's about. But most people go, oh, crap, how awful, I can't believe, and they don't want to face it, they put it off to the last minute. You want to be the kind of person who would be like Alexander with a sword going, where's the next one? And moving through the organization. Because each one of these is a unique opportunity to resolve multiple issues simultaneously. Yes, it's hard work. SWAT teams train. Not just anybody gets to wear that suit, right? They got to be ready to take the heat. But you've got people who know how to take the heat, then it's fun. Then you can get in, even though there's a lot on the line. But you know what? If you're in a change initiative, when is there not a lot on the line? I mean, isn't that why you're there? Right? Okay. The last one is work-life success. I've got a little bit of heat for putting this chapter in. The book's not even published yet. Work-life success. Listen, what does that have to do with change? The first team that I ever worked with, two of these folks are here in the room, we did barbecues together. I remember when Leslie's daughter was crawling underneath the table and untying my shoelaces at our meeting. I mean, we did lots of different things together, not just work. And it all melded together. We learned a whole different way of being as a team. Work-life success means that if you're going to be successful in work, you need to be successful in life. And actually, there's not a big difference between the two. It's all integrated. And so I talk about how do you draw the successes from your life. I mean, I got to use street theater and ritual performance art in my work. How cool is that? For me, it's very cool because that's who I am. But that's an example of working in a way that's fully integrated. Right? Okay. So that's what that's all about. It's now 15:15. I know we just got 15 minutes. We want to go into a process, but let me just give you, let's take a couple of minutes and just answer any questions. Yes?
What happened with Wilkinson and his directors after the...
We had meetings on a regular basis. The first meeting was fantastic. We had a debate between Wilkinson, a vice president, and a project manager. So 3 different levels in the organization. They were actually disagreeing with each other in front of the entire group. And that is major success. Mm. After that, we rolled forward. We just had regular meetings.
Did Wilkinson come early? So this was part of the tea party?
No, he didn't. He didn't come early. We had an incident with his coffee. There's a story there. This isn't even related to what we're saying, but I have to share it.
know. And he gave it to someone, and he said,
go get what he wants,
you know. So the guy came by and he gave it to this woman, Patricia Ogren, who's sitting right next to me. And he said, do you want his coffee? And she said, he may be my president, but I'm not swapping spit with the guy. I told you it had nothing to do with it. Anyway, no, he didn't come early. He just showed up. But he didn't say, Wolverton was very good in front of crowds. That's one of his super strong suits. He was very effusive. He was elegant. He was, you know, he just worked really good in front of crowds. But he just showed up and did that. Yes?
When I look at this, it seems to be a set of tactics, but what I'm grasping with is usually there's a point to the change, so where
right.
the goal setting and all that piece come in?
You need to know what you're about. And this book is designed for many different kinds of changes, so it doesn't get into that. I even warn people against too much project planning. Project planning needs to emerge from the process. You need to know where you're going. We knew that we wanted to transform the organization so that the knowledge was available to the beneficiaries. Right? That we wanted to shift the organization from we have money and we're going to help you do your project to kind of activating the collective wisdom and experience of people across the globe. We knew that. Now, we build plans all the time. We're constantly refining it, too. There is some project planning. I don't want to be totally down with project planning.
I was more on the formal topic. Your goal in this particular case, in general, is some where we want to go. You've got to set the compass somewhere, right?
Yes, you do. You have to know an intention. You have to know what it's about. Absolutely. Okay, great. Yes?
How do you know when an organization needs to change?
How do you know when it needs to change? The way that I, well, okay, now I'm kind of a change guy for hire. So the way I know is that somebody is going to write me a big check because you're a happy thing, right? But back in the old days, when I was an employee, the way that I would know that an organization needs to change is that I would start seeing it everywhere. It's like the whole system was converging on it. I'd go into an elevator and somebody would say something to me, then I'd be in a meeting, someone would say something else, I'd be somewhere else, and I'd start connecting the dots, and I'd go, oh, something's about to happen here. Sometimes you have a visionary. Steve was a visionary. He saw, you know, he went out and said, this is where the World Bank needs to go. It's not about lending money anymore. It's about knowledge. It's about experience. So sometimes you have somebody who's got a vision. Sometimes you just have a whole system that's coming to a head. Things aren't working. Things are broken. Different in different situations.
But do things have to be broken?
No, they don't have to be broken. Sometimes you get people who just want to raise the bar, who see the potential of where to go next. Usually it's one of those two things. I mean, I don't know what other categories there are. If something's broken, needs to be fixed, or want to raise the bar, move to another level of performance. Yes?
I'm curious about how you were talking about seeing the meeting space as a theater environment and setting it up that way to create the social interaction that you're going for. Have you thought about specific individuals in that space as characters?
Sure, yeah. When you get down to the most valuable player list, you start looking at the individuals in there, you start asking yourself the question. You mean like actually characterizing them, like turning them into an archetype or something like that?
That's one way.
This is the evil boss, or,
certain people in organizations, you know, they're there for a long time, and, you know, everybody kind of knows more or less what they're like. And so when you're just thinking about it as this bigger stage picture, but also as a...
What I'm constantly trying to do is engineer the situation so that we can have a breakthrough, so that things can move forward rapidly. So sometimes I'm fighting those. You know, oh, we don't want to work with the vice president because he'll lash out at somebody and, you know, fire him on the spot, that'll be a big mess, and blah, 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 blah. We have to, like, somehow break that crystal, shake that up, because we need the vice president in the room. He has to be able to work arm in arm with these people. So I'm always thinking about that future state. What is it that I'm trying to get out of this, and how do we engineer the event so that the people will make that happen? But yes, you do need to take into account the different personalities and quirks of individuals.
How do you handle that resistance?
What resistance?
You know, you're trying to create a more casual, conversational style, and you've got these people that are very formal and very uptight, and they want it formalized and professional, and you're trying to elicit something more from them, and they fight that because it's not their comfort zone.
You have to find a crack in their armor.
Where the light comes
in. The guy was... At one of the storytelling think tanks that we did in Jonesboro, there was a guy there who was a consultant who got hired to go down to a nuclear reactor where they had stopped working. There had been this fight that had happened internally among the staff, and they stopped running the nuclear reactor to fight. And the company was losing $3 million a day. And he got flown down there to break the jam. And he stayed there for 2 weeks and was unable to do anything. And
until one day, one of the guys mentioned that they were all going to go duck hunting at 5 a.m. or 4 a.m., some ridiculous. This guy did not duck hunt, but he was going duck hunting because everybody on staff, what all people were fighting together, went duck hunting together. So you got to look for where, and he did it, you know, out in the marshes with the hip boots and the gun. That's when he was able to start the conversation. You got to ask the question, where do we need to go in order to have the right conversation? And sometimes you have to work around people. Sometimes you go over people, under people. There's all different kinds of ways to do that. In fact, I do a thing in the book on working with resistant people, toxic people. You know, how do you know? What I found is that in 9/10 of the situations, if somebody tells me that somebody is obstinate, that you can't work with them, that they're a problem, 90% of the time they're wrong. It's easy to get through that person. What you need is a different set of tactics for connecting with them. And then I tell you what to do with the other 10%.
Yeah. The challenge I find is you get some people trigger excitement in people. They get really excited, they contribute ideas, and then they almost get too excited. Mm-hmm. And you have these people that are really engaged in your process, really engaged with everything you're doing, the purpose behind it and everything, and you feel a need to almost rein in them a little bit, and you want to do that without a way that doesn't kill their excitement. So how do you kind of work in that space and with those things?
Can you be more specific about them being too excited?
Well, there's, let's say they're contributing a lot of ideas, and it may be a good idea, but it's either not included in what you had planned, or it's an idea that is.
You want that? There's like a misstep right there. You gotta be careful. It's not included in what you had planned. You're not there to control it. Right?
So it's not that I think you're not open, but I think there's some things that people either suggest and it's fine if they're far afield and you can investigate, but even if it's a good idea, it's just that's not an idea that's gonna happen. Let's say. And they're married to that idea. And if
are they married to you taking action on that idea? Or are they just married to that idea? Because if they're just married to it, I'd say, fine, just let them go. Who knows? Sometimes I'll break something open we didn't know could be broken open. If they want me to act on it, it's a different story. Mm-hmm. Then we can talk about how much resources I have, where my attention goes. But
okay, so then how do you talk about having that conversation, keeping them engaged? And, you know, you can explain about resources, but they're like, hey, so that's a good idea. You know, that kind of.
When we were going through it, this maybe gets into the area of being at your advantage, not to have a budget of authority, but it's like we were constantly lighting grass fires everywhere we went, and we were always having people go off on all kinds of wild stuff, all the time. It was like living in that kind of environment. So you're asking the question, what happens when somebody gets excited about something and you feel like they're going in the wrong direction?
Either they're, well, I don't want to take too much time, but either they're overexcited, but you want to, you know, that there may not be action that ultimately results in it, but you want to keep them engaged.
Uh-huh. Well, so keeping them engaged is a matter of having a conversation, finding out what's meaningful to them, where their energy is, helping them direct it. But you really need to remember that you're not controlling them. That's like fundamental to this way of meaning making, right? So if they decide they want to do it, and you think it's a bad idea, that's okay. Right? So, but if there, let's say there's a subordinate, someone who's reporting to you, and you feel like you're going off half stop in the wrong direction, now you have a responsibility to mentor them, to help them to see, so what's the structure here? Where are the guidelines? Where are the guardrails? How can we achieve real benefit? And that's just having a conversation with them. That's engaging. Finding out, why are they going off in that direction? I don't think there's any danger of dampening someone's enthusiasm if you're truly connecting with them. If you're saying to them, stop it, then there's danger of dampening their enthusiasm. But that's not what it's about. It's about telling me who you are. Why are you doing this? Doesn't make sense to me. Explain it to me. Okay, let me tell you what's going on for me. You know, this is where the action is, or this is where the juice is, or this is what I see going on here. It's about that willingness to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just wanted to make what you're saying. Sometimes those types of people that I've experienced before just need attention. So when you have that kind of conversation you're talking about, a lot of times they're overreacting or overstimulating or overconnecting because they want attention.
Overreacting, overstimulating. It's like stimulating to somebody.
The thing is, though, there are people that tend to be a little bit nerdy within the organization, and they might overreact to the change initiative to the point that it becomes detrimental. So, but sometimes that attention you're talking about, telling more, and mentoring them, actually brings them back into
ground
control
them.
And
right.
Grounds them.
Yeah. I'm just concerned. We've got like 5 minutes. I'm looking to Steve.
We should have a process.